This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Effective velocity is a real deal, and we are back for another outstanding show with the Godfather. I know I call him the Godfather. You can call him the Grandfather. Call him whatever you like, but he is the person who introduced effective velocity to the world, Perry Husband. I guarantee you this is going to be an explosive show with lots of fantastic information from the pioneer in the world of baseball science. He is an awesome guy. This is going to be a lot of fun. Hello, everybody. In the U.S. and around the world, welcome to the show. I'm your host, Pete Caliendo, and this is the show that interviews baseball's best coaching minds who love the challenge, the status quo. Don't forget, email me anytime. I know you're going to have a lot of questions after this show, so petercaliendo@att.net. And don't forget, go to my YouTube channel, Peter Caliendo. Check out just the baseball tips of the day. And we want to get rolling with the man who introduced the modern hitting metrics to baseball, including exit velocity and launch angle. He will discuss with us the new EV Liquid Analytics and his new membership program. He needs no introduction. He's been on MLB Network. He is the best in the business. And on the show, it's the third time. So this is a record-breaking time for anybody on Baseball Outside the Box. Perry Husband, welcome, my friend. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. That's a heck of an intro.
Yeah, that's just right off the top of my head. Hey, you know, this is, again, your third time, and the reason we have you on, because effective velocity to me is the thing, and there's so much to learn. Even you can do 10 episodes and still not know enough about it. But lately, I've been on social media, and there's been some excitement. And sometimes, social media, I guess what I like about social media is, you got people out there that might want to challenge things. And challenge is never a bad thing as long as it's done professionally. I think, to ask questions, to maybe try to show another side of it. It gives people to think. It gives them to do different, come up with more, research, science. I love people, obviously, that back it up with science and research and research and development. So let's do this. Let's just start off right away. Let's talk about a little bit on some of the questions you've been getting on social media. And so we can address some of these for our audience in the U.S. and around the world, because this is great stuff.
Let's do it. The baseball or Driveline Baseball did kind of a challenging critique on effective velocity, and they called it not very effective. Kind of attacked a couple different things, and so I spent some time answering all those questions, because it's important, in my opinion, that you answer those questions. And you're right, I do agree that everyone has the right to challenge anything. And I think from the very first thing that I ever did with Jay Bell, the exit velocity test, the hitting as a guest test that we did way back in 2000. When that came out, one of the things that I kept saying was, don't believe a word I'm saying. Go test it. Mm. Don't believe that these mechanics are the best. Go test it for yourself. That's the whole point. And we designed the whole thing around teaching players how to test their own swing. And what ends up happening is, if you don't do that, if you don't test it, then you don't really know. I mean, if you're standing in a round room and you have no corner to measure off of, you don't know where you're at in that round room. And so in baseball, it's really important to measure things. And that was the very beginning of where exit velocity became so important for me. Because it's the answer to a bunch of things. When your exit velocity is maxed out, not only are you mechanically efficient, but you're also on time to the pitch. And so when you start to lose exit velocity, something is causing it. And so as soon as you start looking at it really closely and measuring every element of it, now you can get down to the nth degree and find out exactly what's producing it and what is not. It's as simple as that.
Now, are there challenges when it comes to people asking, you know, they saying that, well, you know, effective velocity when it comes to pitches, actual pitches going in and out, that they don't change the velocity of the pitch or the effective velocity of it?
Yeah, that was one of the claims, was that that EV miles an hour is kind of a little secret way to look at pitch speeds, because one of the baseline elements of EV is that speed changes. It depends on where you throw 90 miles an hour or 95 miles an hour. Wherever you throw that pitch, the hitter has a different reach. You know, it's like an airplane taking off. If you just say that a pitch is 90 miles an hour, it's like saying an airplane's going 600 miles an hour and trying to figure out when it's going to land. You know, and there's a lot of stuff you got to know before you know exactly how long that plane's going to be in the air, right? You got to know, first off, where is it taking off? Second, what are the wind conditions? How far do you have to travel? What is the speed that you're going to go? I mean, there's a speed to get up to speed to get up in the air, and then there's a slowdown speed in order to land. And so you got all these factors you got to figure in. But as soon as you get on a plane, a guy says the pilot says we're going to land at 3:38 or whatever the time is, and he's almost exactly right. And the reason is because he has all the factors figured into it. And that's what EV is. EV is, from the moment the ball leaves the pitcher's hand, it's going to travel X miles an hour. It's going to travel X distance because he let go of it. Most pitchers are going to release the ball 55, 54, you know, 53 feet even. Mm-hmm. It depends on the, you know, how far off the plate or how far off the rubber they get when they let go of the ball. But once that ball is in flight, all of the factors that figure where it's going to end up and how long it's going to take, those are all factors exactly like a plane. Mm. The ball's going to slow down. Every pitch loses speed by the time it gets to home plate. So you figure that in. You figure out how fast the ball's traveling. And then the last thing you have to figure out in the airline analogy, you got to know where you're landing. If you just say, I'm going to the East Coast, that's not good enough to be able to know when to pick you up, right? If I'm in Boston or if I'm in New York or wherever I might have to pick you up, I need an exact place because that tells me when I have to be there. Mm-hmm. And the contact point for effective velocity is, where do you have to be if you're going to do damage on a pitch that's 95 miles an hour up and in? Mm-hmm. So when you pinpoint it like that, now I know that for me to do damage, I need to get the barrel to a certain place and time at a certain time in order to be what we call 100-100. Mm-hmm. 100% on time with 100% of my mechanical efficiency. So if both of those things come into play, if both of those things are maxed out, both how well I swing the bat and the timing of the pitch, that's when the hitter is going to do damage. That's the 100-100 mm-hmm. contact point. So what matters in this is that you understand where that spot is. And so it's very simple, in my opinion. It started way back in 2000 with Jay Bell's swing. Where do you produce the maximum exit velocity? And there is a place. When you move the ball middle in or up and in or down and away or middle away, every time you move the contact point there, the location of the pitch, it changes the contact point where you get your maximum exit velocity. Mm-hmm. Not okay exit velocity, your maximum exit velocity. And so that's where the confusion sets in with effective velocity. Driveline study, they showed a bunch of contact points from their hitters within their own organization. And in those contact points, they were very different than what I would call the maximum exit velocity numbers. In other words, they showed a swing path that was much shallower, they were letting the fastball get very deep in order to be able to hit it later, so that the time that it took to hit that pitch was not the same as it is when you hit, when you have to hit the ball at 100.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, for my swing in particular, I've got to be about 25 to 30 inches out in front of home plate if I'm going to max out and hit the ball at 100. If you throw a fastball middle in, if you throw in their instance that they showed, the data that they showed, their contact point was about 13 inches in front of home plate. So it was dramatically different. It was 16 inches closer than the one that would be what my perfect contact point would be. And I'm 5'9" with average length of arms. I swing a 34 inch bat. And so with all those factors figured in, that's the contact point for me personally. It gets really complex when you look at it, because if I move or choke up, or
sure,
if I move closer to the dish, or if I move closer to the pitcher, further away from the pitcher, mm-hmm, all those contact points change all of a
sure
sudden, right?
Sure, sure.
So it becomes very, very, very complex. But in order for us to be precise, we have to look at every single tiny little detail in order to make it precise. Where exactly did the pitcher let go of it? What was the exact miles per hour of the fastest point? And then at the end of it, it is, where do I have to hit it in order to make to do the most damage? And that's the 100-100 contact point. They used a contact point that was much closer, and it was for about, you know, somewhere between, let's put it this way. I used Mike Trout as the example, figuring he's probably the best hitter maybe in history, but definitely in the last 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked at his philosophy on this is kind of similar to what the way those guys look at it and the way baseball looks at it, which is wait to see the pitch. When you recognize it, if it's inside, you pull your hands in and you try to make a smaller swing arc in order to hit the ball. Like a swing, I call it a swing adjust theory. And that's basically the idea of I'm going to load, I'm going to see the pitch, and then if the pitch is in a weird place, like up and in, then I'm going to adjust my swing in order to make up for that time.
Mm-hmm.
So the question immediately becomes, well, what happens? What, do I lose speed? Do I lose exit velocity when that happens? And so Mike Trout, I thought, would be a great example. Over in 2018, his average was 80 miles an hour when he did that. So you look at only up and in pitches against Mike Trout, up and in fastballs, I should say. When you get up and in fastballs against him, in that plus side of the strike zone, he averages 80 miles an hour of exit velocity. You go to the down and away area, which is actually a third of the strike zone, middle away box, the down and away box, and the middle down box, and you put all those together, he averages 101.
Wow.
So when you throw fastballs away or down to Mike Trout, he averages 101. And then I went ahead and I looked at, and that's a 20 mile an hour difference.
Sure.
But just moving the fastball to the plus side of the strike zone, in Mike Trout's case, he loses 32% of his power.
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion, that's pretty significant. Now, when you go to the up and in extreme box of the strike zone, he lost 38% of his max.
Mm-hmm.
Because what EV says, EV miles per hour says, is when you move to middle in, there's it adjusts the speed a little bit. When you move to up and in, it adjusts it even one more step. And when you look at his statistics, it shows exactly the same thing. It shows a significant loss middle in, and then when you go up and in, it shows even a more significant loss. So it goes to 32% overall, 38% loss off of his max when you get to that up and in part of the strike zone. So the question is that real enough evidence to show you that speed is changing dramatically when pitches get to the inside part of the plate? And the answer is, from my perspective, not yes, but hell yes. It's making a significant difference when you're taking the best hitter in the world and taking 20 miles an hour away from his exit velocity.
Yeah, and Perry, we got a lot to delve in because I got so many notes here. I don't know where to start, but I do have this idea. From a common sense standpoint, that's all I could use because I don't have the statistics and the science behind me. And later on, if Driveline would like to come on the show and talk about their end of it, great. What I'd really love to do eventually, and nobody has to commit now, would be to get both you guys on here and discuss this. But let's start with this. If I understand this correctly, the counter argument is for both the effective velocity of the pitch in different locations. They're saying that it doesn't change speeds if you throw it away or in. And on top of it, the exit velocity doesn't change either. They're saying
they didn't allude to that in their study. They didn't talk about that, which is one of those things. It's like the airline pilot leaving out the speed of the plane. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't add exit velocity to those contact points, they don't really, you're back into the round room. You have no way to measure that. So
what's their counter argument to
well,
this?
Well, the counter argument would be, when you make a smaller swing arc, what they're saying is we can cover the whole strike zone with an 11-inch swing pass. Meaning, if I pull my hands in and I hit the fastball deeper, mm-hmm. then not only do I cover that, but I also cover the outside part of the plate where I get extended, and then I do my damage on the fastball away, and then I'm going to kind of let the off-speed pitches pull themselves, and then I'm going to adjust on the fastball in as best I can.
Wow.
And all that's great. It's the number one thought process in Major League Baseball. So it's not like it's not real. Real big time hitters, most Major League hitters have that approach. But that approach, in order to put a measurement to it, you have to test and find out which elements and how far away it is how much do you lose when you have that approach on certain parts of the strike zone? So it's the reason why effective velocity works, is because when a hitter loads up and they try to see a pitch and then recognize it and then adjust their swing at those kinds of reactionary times, 0.40 seconds is a 95 mile an hour fastball. But 0.40 seconds depends totally on where you throw it. As soon as you throw it inside and up, you now have about 0.38 seconds in order to be on time at 100% on time. Mm-hmm. And that's a dramatic difference. That's a huge difference in how much overall reactionary time you have. You have to start your swing at about 0.250 to 260 seconds if you're going to be on time to a pitch that is that's 95 miles an hour up and in. That's a very important number, that if you don't understand how that works, like for example, if I wait until the ball gets deep enough to where I'm going to recognize what the speed of that pitch is, and then I realize that it's 95 and it's up and in, and I'm going to pull my hands in and try to adjust to that pitch, that means I'm reacting to the ball at about 0.28 seconds. And it takes every hitter in the big leagues 0.13 to 0.15 seconds to swing the bat. So one third of that flight at 95 miles an hour is taken up by swinging the bat. So it's just human frailty. It's humans not being strong enough to swing the bat faster in mm-hmm. order to be able to adjust that. It takes that much time. So if it takes that much time and I wait too long to recognize the pitch, then I can't possibly get to the perfect spot where I'm going to do the most damage by waiting long enough to see it. Now, the other question is it working? And if you look at Mike Trout, you have to say, well, yes, it's working. I mean, he's killing it. But is that really him doing all of that, or is some of that success due to pitchers not understanding how mm-hmm. to maximize what it is that they have, what tools they have? And that's where effective velocity really starts to explain what's going on in today's game. Is as soon as you understand that Mike Trout loses 38% of his power on up and in fastballs in the strike zone, why would you throw anything other than that? Yet when you look at all of his homers, the bulk of them, and he does occasionally pull his hands in and hit a homer on that plus side of the strike zone, don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, he's failing at an overall exit velocity that's going to do damage day in and day out in that area. So why would he ever get a fastball in that other area where he just absolutely smokes it day in and day out? And that's one of those questions is, well, why throw anything other than that fastball to that particular player at that velocity? If you possess that velocity, why would you waste it and throw it in an area that's down and away? And so the strategy starts to elevate really quickly when you really understand what that EV miles per hour does to the at-bat. I know we're starting to get a little bit too crazy with with complexities, but when you look at Major League Baseball all of Major League Baseball, like all right-handed hitters, if you look at all right-handed hitters in Major League Baseball, when you throw the ball to the plus side of the strike zone,
mm-hmm.
their average exit velocity is 84 miles an hour. So if all right-handed pitchers lived in the up and in part of the strike zone, the average exit velocity would be somewhere in that range, because that's what it is in real life. That's not my theory. That's just what StatCast says, that all of the pitches that right-handed pitchers throw against right-handed batters, when they're in that plus side of the strike zone, the average exit velocity is 84. That's a significant. And when you throw it down and away, it jumps up to like 91.
Wow.
And so all of Major League Baseball has the same effects that we saw in Mike Trout when you single him out. I mean, I'm a big fan of Trout. I'm not trying to say his theory doesn't work or anything like that. It's about just showing what the facts are. It's about looking at the individual facts of what makes up his mindset and his approach. And it works as long as pitchers cooperate. As long as pitchers throw enough fastballs away or down or both, and then they throw off-speed pitches that he can recognize, he is unbelievably good at that, those two things. But from an EV standpoint, I'm not doing either one of those things. Both of those things are at risk. Both of those throwing fastballs where they're losing speed, and not only are they losing speed because he has more time to react to them, but there's something else that happens, and that is the visual deception goes down dramatically. Because if I throw you a fastball away and you're a right-handed hitter and I'm a right-handed pitcher, as soon as I throw the fastball down and away, you see it instantly, right? It's very recognizable because you've seen it a million times. But now I throw any off-speed pitch, slider, curveball, changeup, and it's going to the same location away. It's physically impossible for those pitches to look alike and go to the same place at different speeds. It's not physically possible. So in other words, not only are you losing speed on that fastball, you're also losing the visual deception.
Mm-hmm.
So I recognize it sooner.
Yep.
I have more time to hit it. And the speed differential between the off-speed and the fastball is not as great.
And you mentioned all the factors. I mean, earlier you said, you know, I mean, what about release points? You know, everybody has different release points, different heights,
right,
different contact points, vision, you know, goes into effect. Now, I thought I read that, you know, they also mentioned that the fastball in and out is unlikely to benefit pitchers. Now, I did, you know, again, I'm going on common sense. I've done a lot of soft toss through a lot of batting practice, professional baseball, and every time I move the ball in and out on batting practice or soft toss, boy, guys struggled. I can see the difference in their timing. I can see the difference in, you know, the exit velocity. I didn't have at that time, you know, the machines to test it. But you know, I mean, of course, if you move the ball in and out, it's going to help pitchers. I don't understand that part.
Well, I did a basic study after this, and I looked at just moving the ball up versus down. Mm-hmm. So I took the top three boxes and used all hitters versus all pitchers, and took the top three boxes plus the area up above the strike zone. So elevated fastballs versus fastballs down at the bottom of the strike zone. And I used the three bottom boxes in the strike zone and then everything below that. And when you look at it that simply, all fastballs up versus all fastballs down. And what I ran a batting average, WOBA, ex-WOBA, slugging percentage, BABIP, ISO power, and every one of those numbers, when you look at every one of those numbers, including exit velocity, throwing the ball at the bottom of the strike zone is significantly worse for the pitcher than it is throwing the fastball at the top of the zone.
And we always thought the opposite.
Exactly. We always thought that if you get the fastball up, you're going to get crushed because mm-hmm. big league hitters will hit that. The truth of it is that that's completely and utterly untrue.
And we're seeing that now in Major League Baseball. Look at all the pitching that's going up and the guys are missing.
Yeah, but there's still a significant amount, and you do see that, but you mm-hmm. see it with who? You see it with the Verlanders. You see it with the guys that are having the most success.
Mm-hmm.
Last year's Cy Young winner, DeGrom, he averaged elevating his fastball about 59% of the time. The Boston Red Sox averaged elevating their fastballs as a team 52% of the time. The league averaged around 40-something percent, 43, I think, was the overall average.
Mm-hmm.
The lowest teams in baseball averaged about 38 to 39% use up there.
So, Perry, what you're saying is pitching up high is a benefit, but for certain pitchers?
No, it's all pitchers.
Yeah, all pitchers. Okay.
Yeah. I did a study on low spin fastballs versus high spin because when I talked to Driveline and asked them through, you know, we DM back and forth, and I asked the author, you know, give me some guys that you guys use your pitch philosophy, your pitch sequencing philosophy. Since you're, you know, looking at mine, I'm gonna take a little look at yours and see how your guys are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, we don't really have one. We don't have a philosophy on sequencing. And I thought it took me aback a little bit, like seriously.
Hmm.
So what he offered was, he said, the only thing we talk about is the fact that high spin rate fastballs should be up in the zone and low spin rate fastballs should be down in the zone. According to their movement and all of that stuff put together, they're going to have more success down in the zone. So I looked at that. I took mm-hmm. the really low spin rate fastball of 2000 RPMs or less and looked at all those same stats. And only isolated power was the only one, and WOBA by like 2%. So it was almost dead equal. But all the other numbers, slugging percentage, batting average, exit velocity was about 5 miles an hour, 6 miles an hour higher on at the bottom of the strike zone than it was at the top. So again, even on low spin fastballs, they do much, much better at the top of the strike zone than they do at the bottom of the strike zone.
And I just want to, just for a second, I want to stop here because I'm going back to my common sense. I watch games every day, and here in Chicago, we've got you know, the professor who pitches for the Cubs, and I've seen many times where he threw a fastball, and he doesn't throw faster than 89 miles an hour that I've seen, sometimes 90, 91, very rarely. And I've seen him strike guys out on a high fastball, which was about 87 miles an hour, you know, 86. And you wonder, wow, how do you do that?
Yeah, well, it's significant to understand how that works. I'm not saying that every guy that has low spin and low velocity should live at the top of the strike zone.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what effective velocity is about. It's about designing a pitch assortment that matches everything that you do. That's the whole idea of effective velocity. I mean, Dallas Keuchel, won a Cy Young in 2015, and he did not elevate very often. When he did, however, it was ridiculously successful because guys are so not prepared for that.
Mm-hmm.
But he also lived in an area where he had a lot of deception when he threw his fastball down and away. And it made a lot of sense for him to throw fastballs down and away to a certain degree because it sets up a trap. And as long as hitters are going to cooperate with you, from my perspective, he won a Cy Young with his B approach, meaning he set up an outside fastball, changeup would hide off of that, and it would be off the plate, down and away. A slider would hide off of that outside fastball, and it would be down and middle to a right-handed batter. And then he would throw a fastball up and away that was out of the strike zone that was also a chase pitch. So you throw all of those pitches off of that one fastball away. So if you took that one fastball away strike, it's very likely the next three or four pitches that you're going to see are going to be hidden. You can't see the difference between the off speed, and now it's off the plate and you're chasing it. And so his chase rate was off the chart, especially with two strikes. He had as high as like a 68 or 69% strike rate at times in two strike counts, but it was only in the zone like 21 or 22% of the time, meaning he's literally making guys chase pitches out of the strike zone just a huge amount of the time. And it happens because of setting up a little trap. But the issue with that is that you have to understand how the whole process works in order to set up a plan that truly makes sense by living down and away. And he did. He lived right down and away with his fastball.
Perry, I got to ask you this, and then I don't mean to interrupt, but I want to make sure we get certain things in, because I know if I've got some questions, our audience is going to have these questions too. there's kind of three here. First of all, I want you to explain to our audience, high spin rate, low spin rate, does that correlate to miles per hour also, or, you know, can you have low spin rate and get a little bit more miles per hour? Just want to address that. Roba, explain what that is. And then the question I'm going to have is the same concept up and down, which one's better, away or in?
That's a lot of stuff.
Yeah. So let's start with the spin rate, high spin rate, low spin rate. Does that correlate to velocity?
Absolutely. High okay. spin rate is a very important factor. Mm-hmm. If you have a high spin rate fastball, your fastball is going to sink less.
But so it's going to also move faster?
No, it doesn't necessarily move faster.
That's my question.
That's kind of a weird, thing is that in general, when guys have a lot of spin, they mm-hmm. they throw hard mm-hmm. because that's one of the reasons why it spins so much is they're generating a lot of that.
Right.
But at the end of the day, it's about what does that spin do? So when you look at a high spin rate guy and he throws the fastball at the bottom of the strike zone, that spin is hurting him way more than it's helping him. So when you look at a typical guy like Verlander, Cole, guys that throw and have a high spin rate, super high spin rate, like elite level, when you look at their fastballs at the bottom of the strike zone, they get crushed. They average like 96 miles an hour of exit velocity. And the reason is because the spin is keeping the ball up just enough to where as the lower the pitch goes, the more counter it's countering the effect of what the spin is supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get a high spin rate fastball and you're using it all over the strike zone, it's only helping you at the top of the strike zone. It's not helping you at the bottom of the strike
bottom.
Zone.
Interesting.
And the same thing is true with a low spin rate fastball. There's a ton of examples of guys that dominate at the top of the strike zone. They don't do it often, but they dominate because the most important factor is not the spin. The most important factor is how much time does the hitter have to react to it. So speed is by far the most important element when it comes to controlling the at-bat and controlling exit velocity.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a low spin fastball and you use it exclusively at the bottom of the strike zone, there's a lot of bad stuff that's going to happen as a result of that if you do it without understanding how this whole thing meshes together. You know the old idea of a curveball when it has topspin. Guys are going to hit the curveball very far because the topspin curveball comes in, the guy hits it below the center of the ball, and the spin just continues, right?
Mm-hmm.
It continues to have backspin on the ball that's hit. Well, when you throw a fastball with backspin and then the hitter hits it and he hits it in the air, the ball has to reverse the spin. You have to reverse the spin, and there's a little bit of energy lost there.
Mm.
So what happens when you hit, when you throw a fastball at the bottom of the strike zone and it's got backspin, and then the bat hits just barely above the top of the center? Now that backspin is now going to be continued right into topspin ground balls. So when you look at all those ground balls that are hit in that fashion, they have a higher exit velocity because they don't lose that same energy that the curveball doesn't lose when the hitter hits it.
Mm-hmm.
So using your fastball at the bottom of the strike zone, not only are you going to give up harder hit balls, not only are you going to have all of those stats be slightly worse, but you're also going to create harder ground balls. The one thing that you're after, trying to create ground balls, is actually going to kind of backfire because ground balls are not as bad as we've been led to believe.
as long as the exit velocity is a certain level.
Well, yeah, but look, I mean, I would even go further than that.
Mm.
I did a study in within this little world. I looked at ground balls and put them against fly balls because all we've heard for the last 10 years is that fly balls, I don't, you know, say no to ground balls. Kids, when your coaches tell you to hit ground balls, you say no. And, you know, you make all your money on fly balls. And the answer to that is, well, yeah, if you hit them at your max,
mm-hmm.
if you hit the fly ball at max and the ball leaves the yard, then of course it's really good. I mean, that's like one of the dumb moments of all time. If I hit the ball really hard, 100 miles an hour, and I hit it in the air, it's a homer. Oh, okay. That's a great, that's brilliant. That we've known that since the first day of the game ever being played. But what happens when you try to hit it up there all the time? And the answer is really bad mishits is what happens. And that's why we're seeing what we're seeing in Major League Baseball right now. Mm-hmm. Is you're seeing guys trying to hit 25 to 30 degree fly balls. And they're, when you miss it, not only do you swing and miss more, but you also have uglier misses. Your pop-ups, you hit more pop-ups, and you hit uglier ground balls because you're topping it more.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start to look at fly balls versus ground balls, which is something that analytics shows us all the time, but there's a little trick that they use. Number one, they take pop-ups out in a lot of studies that I've seen. They take the pop-ups completely out. So they're only looking at fly balls and line drives put together. And then they put that against ground balls. And they don't even take out the dribblers of the ground balls. So they take out the worst fly balls, and they put in the best line drives plus the best fly balls together in order to look at those stats against ground balls. So, of course, that's going to win, right?
Sure, sure.
You can't help but win. But when you look at ground balls versus fly balls and you include the pop-ups and then you look at ground balls exclusively and you look at batting average, there's a gigantic difference between them. For example, 90-mile-an-hour ground balls or higher at the major league level, the average batting average is around 384.
Hmm.
When you take 95-mile-an-hour ground balls, which is considered a hard hit ball,
mm-hmm.
95 miles an hour, it goes up to almost 400, like 398, I think, is the number.
Mm-hmm.
And then at 100 miles an hour, the batting average goes to 441. And this is not a top out. This is average major league batting average on 100 mile an hour ground balls is 441. So take a wild guess when you look at 95 miles an hour, which is the hard hit ball, 95 or less in the fly balls, because 95 is enough to be a homer, although some of those are going to stay in the yard. So, but it's primarily looking at the balls that are going to stay in the yard. And then I included pop-ups in that. What do you think the batting average is, the average major league batting average is on fly balls?
95 or lower.
95 or lower.
240.
How about 078?
Wow.
078 is the major league average when you include pop-ups and you keep the ball in the yard on fly balls. So, yes, of course, when you hit, you're trying to hit the ball at your maximum exit velocity and you're trying to hit it out of the yard. But the second that doesn't happen and it stays in the yard, the batting average is 078.
Mm-hmm. Perry,
so you're
go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, go, finish.
You're three or four times more likely to get a ground ball hit than you are a fly ball hit. And that's not really the point of this. My point is this, is that if your goal is to get ground balls and your pitch sequencing methodology is to get ground balls, you're going to get them if you live at the bottom of the strike zone. But you're going to get them to the tune of costing you a bunch of other things. There's a bunch of other factors that play into that, that cost you.
Now, on all this, what about the pitches away and in? What are we talking about? Is there a better place to pitch? I know obviously changing helps, but is there a better place to pitch outside more, inside more, for different type of pitchers with spin rates or movements?
Well, of course, if movement is one of those things that that changes effective velocity. For example, if the airplane, if we go back to that analogy and we take off at LAX and we land in New York and we take a route that has an arc to it, then obviously, like, we belly out in order to avoid something, it's going to take more time, right?
Mm-hmm.
For it to get there. So with movement is changing the EV miles per hour based on what it's doing. It's sinking and it's moving to this other spot. And so depending on which hitter we're talking about and which pitcher we're talking about, so if we stay with the righty-righty and you've got a sinker that's moving down and in, it's gaining speed because it's moving closer to the hitter, but it's losing speed because it's sinking. And so those two things kind of counteract each other. So the movement is actually killing that pitcher. When Gerrit Cole was with the Pirates, his exit velocity on that pitch down and in was crazy high, like 94, 95, 96, 97, depending on when you looked at him. But so in other words, every ball that's hit on that pitch is fast enough to be a homer.
Sure. So he would pitch more the sinker away. Is that better?
No, sinker's kind of down and in to right-handed batters, which can be effective, but the speed overall is counteracting each other.
Right.
And so the movement of that pitch with the speed of that pitch is taking it to an area that's super dangerous. They're just accidents waiting to happen. And so that's one of the things that they address when he went to
Houston.
To Houston, because Brent.
Sure.
Brent is one of those guys that's very EV minded.
Mm-hmm.
And we did some work on that. And that was one of the most telling factors, was that sinker down and in from an effective velocity standpoint doesn't make any sense.
So where did he make his change?
So by eliminating some of those to right-handed batters, a dramatic amount of those, and almost putting it on the shelf for a while, and elevating more fastballs, taking advantage of the spin at the top of the strike zone, it dramatically changes everything about what he does.
Wow.
So now all of a sudden, instead of having a pitch that is working against effective velocity, he's now utilizing more pitches that are working with effective velocity. So the four-seam fastball up, the spin is actually helping him now. And now combine that with the spin rate on the slider that's moving away but coming out of the same tunnel. So now you're taking away reaction time you are changing the angle. There's so many factors. If I throw a fastball down, it's going to be somewhere around 7 or 8 or 9 degrees downward at the bottom of the strike zone and about two to four degrees at the top of the strike zone. So almost flat at the top of the strike zone. So when he was throwing the sinker down, he's got more of like a 7 or 8 degree angle. And let's just look at the average hitter in the big leagues. What's their swing plane look like? Well, it's up about 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 or 12 degrees.
Sure.
So what happens? I mean, that's a happy accident waiting to happen, right? I'm throwing directly into traffic.
Yeah.
By using that movement, no matter how nasty that pitch is, it's heading towards the bat head all the time. And so it's only a matter of time before hard contact takes place. And when you eliminate that, then all of a sudden, hard hit balls become much, much more difficult to attain.
So without using the science, that's kind of like we used to say, you know, left-handed hitters were low ball hitters. That's where their swing was at. So why would you pitch there?
Yeah, and that's actually false.
That is false.
Hitters, actually, right-handers, when you look at it, I did a two-year study. Right-handers actually hit the ball better down and in than lefties do.
Wow.
I know, it's a weird concept to think about, but it was fairly significant. If I remember right, I think it was like 8 or 9% better when you look at the whole overall area of down and in. When you look at just the down and in box in the strike zone, lefties typically do a little bit better than righties.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the whole area, righties are better.
Wow.
When you look at the middle in, down and middle, and then the pressure zone outside the strike zone, and you do that same thing to lefties, righties are better.
Wow, interesting. And that, you know, and that goes to show how important science is to be able to understand exactly how things happen, you know, how the body moves, what the contact points are. I mean, science helps us so much. Perry, if I was to ask you, you know, hitters, you know, I know there's a high strikeout, you know, going on in the big leagues right now, a lot more home runs, more strikeouts, less walks. If hitters wanted to catch up, because it sounds like hitters need to catch up to pitchers, and if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but they have to study this and understand this better than pitchers do.
Yes. Pitchers made a big surge about 10 years ago, 12 years ago. They started really working on throwing the ball harder and creating better stuff.
Yep. Right?
Ron Wolforth, Tom House, all those guys were focused on that whole concept. And it worked. You know, they started throwing the ball harder, plain and simple. They focused on it. They methodically went about doing things that would mechanically get them better. And it worked. So what did the hitters do? They did absolutely nothing. They stayed in the same place that they've always been. So here's the problem. Here's the good news for the hitters is that as long as pitchers keep throwing fastballs up, down, in and out, and they keep missing locations with other pitches, that's always going to happen no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to miss locations. You're going to make mistakes. What effective velocity is saying is that pitchers are making mistakes in strategy. Not as much of like mislocations as you think, even though that does happen every day. But the part that I'm talking about is the on purpose designing pitches that are heading right into a bat, like the Cole right-handed sinker down and in.
Mm-hmm.
That's heading towards the bat, even though it's nasty. It's 98, 100 miles an hour, great movement, but still that thing was getting hit very hard. And it should never be hit hard. If movement and nastiness was the reason that caused hitters to swing and miss, then that pitch of all the pitches that he threw should be the one that had the highest swing and miss rate. But it didn't. It had the lowest of the other fastballs. So when you start really looking at things from that perspective and measuring it, then all of a sudden now it really starts to show you what the issues are. Mm-hmm. The problem is that pitchers are still making enough strategic mistakes where their philosophy is to throw like the low spin fastball concept down, mm-hmm. keeping that down in the strike zone.
Yeah.
That's killing them, and they don't even know it. And so as long as they keep doing those on purpose pitch sequencing mistakes, then hitters have a target-rich environment that they just keep swinging hard, and there's going to be a lot of pitches show up in that area where you can do damage. Mm-hmm. And as long as that's the case, why switch? They don't have a reason to switch because they're still having success.
Mm-hmm. And hitters, they should be working on increasing their bat speed. Is that a benefit?
Well, absolutely. Anytime you can increase anything, you know, if you can get quicker, the world is spending a lot of time trying to figure out ways to recognize pitches faster. And that is one of those things that we could talk about for hours.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, it takes hitters 0.13 seconds to 0.15 seconds to swing the bat. Can you get quicker? A very little bit, yes, you can. Does bat speed help? Yes, a very little bit, it does.
Mm-hmm.
And so is that pursuit worth it? Yes, absolutely. But is it the end game answer?
No.
It absolutely is not.
Yep.
It's a waste of time from the perspective of learning how to hit.
And understanding effective velocity is the key.
Yeah, 100%. Because if you don't know what's happening, if you don't know why you're swinging and missing or why you're late, or if you're not measuring how early or late you are, then you really don't know what to fix. So you really are flipping a coin when it comes to your strategy. So if a hitter goes to the plate every day with the same approach and they're facing Dallas Keuchel one day and Garrett Cole the next, and yet you have the same basic plan, you're going to – that those are two very, very different approaches that have to be acknowledged, and yet that's not what's taking place very often.
No, we've got the same plan pretty much for every pitcher.
Right. And there have been some advancements in that world. But it's like if you and I play chess and we know how the pieces move, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you randomly make a bunch of moves. I don't know anything about strategy, so I randomly move my horsey and my, you know, whatever piece, my queen. And so sometimes I make a great move and sometimes I make a terrible move. And same for you. And so we don't have any idea who's going to win. We just keep going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And you win one, I win one, you win three, I win two.
It's called
and
luck.
At the end of the day, nobody gets any better because we don't know what a good move is.
Right.
And then until there's some strategy thrown into it, then you it's constantly a flip of the coin.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, pitch sequencing is a flip of the coin because as long as you're moving fastballs in and out, up and down, you're changing the speed, like off a 90-mile-an-hour pitch. You're taking 90 and turning it into 85 down and away, 87.5 middle away. Middle in, it's 92.5 or so. And then up and in, it's 95. So which one of those pitches are you throwing? If you mix them all over the place and then you mix like an 85 version of that fastball with an 85-mile-an-hour slider, all of a sudden now you run into the most common hard hit ball there is. 50% of all the hard hit balls that we've ever looked at. And one year, I mean, I don't know if you saw the thing on MLB Network that Carlos Pena did.
Mm-hmm.
We predicted ahead of time before the first pitch was thrown exactly how the hard hit balls were going to go. And we picked the four categories, put a percentage in each category, and they came out almost precisely like we guessed. And it wasn't really a guess. It was understanding that hard hit balls happen the same way all day, every day, from the very first pitch ever thrown in baseball to tonight's baseball game. I can tell you that if you look at all the games played tonight, 50% of the hard hit balls that will take place tonight
mm-hmm.
are going to happen within 6 EV miles an hour of the last pitch. So if you throw 90, but you throw it down and away and it's 85, and the next pitch you throw is 87, those two are within 6 miles an hour of each other, and mm-hmm. that's going to take up 50% of the hard hit balls that you see in tomorrow's highlights.
And that's where vision takes place, right?
What's that?
That's that your visual aspect determines that, because it's seeing the pitches, and the speed isn't that much of a difference.
Well, that depends on, because there's lots of ways to get within 6 EV miles an hour. So if I throw a fastball down and away, you see it right away, and you have more time to hit it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I throw a slider down and away, it's going to pop over that fastball. You're going to see it, recognize it early,
really early.
So in that case, yes, visual is very important, and it plays a big role in that. But what if I throw a fastball, what if you're a lefty hitter, and I'm a righty pitcher, and I throw a fastball that is up and away.
Mm-hmm.
To a righty hitter, that up and in pitch, that pitch that would be up and in, the arm side run, that's going to be gaining a lot of speed.
Mm-hmm.
But to a lefty, it's right on that EV diagonal.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's whatever the radar gun says it is. So if I throw 95, then that pitch is 95 up and away. It's 95 middle, it's 95 down and in. So everywhere along that diagonal, it's going to be the same reactionary time. And when you look at exit velocity of major league hitters, and you look at the up and away, middle, down and in, they're all within about a mile an hour of each other with the overall average exit velocity.
Wow.
Because they have the same reactionary time.
Mm-hmm.
So but what if I throw a cutter now at 91 and it's middle in to that lefty? So now the hitter that 91 cutter turns into 94 EV. The up and away fastball is 95 EV. This is 94 EV.
Easy.
So with the same swing of the bat, that cutter is now running right into the same bat path
mm-hmm.
that the up and away pitch would. And so the visual doesn't play quite as big a role in that, because they can't really see the difference between those two pitches.
Sure.
They're going to hide in the same line.
But the speed isn't that much of a difference either.
Exactly. And so the speed ends up killing the pitcher.
Mm.
And he probably executed both of those pitches the way he wanted. Yet, strategically, they make zero sense to throw together in that circumstance.
Wow.
It's just an accident waiting to happen.
Sure.
It's going to happen. It's only a matter of time. So when you go back and you look at all the hard hit balls, like we did in that 2017 postseason, there was 104 homers hit. When you look at each sequence, 49% of those happen on pitches within 6 EV miles an hour of each other. How do you know? Well, you look at the individual sequence, and you see that 96 fastball was away, so it was really 93. And then you look at the next fastball, and it was in an area that was also away, so it was 94. And so those two pitches back-to-back were what created that hard-hit ball. Now, that pitcher might have got away with 10 combinations of fastball away, early in that game, and they didn't result in hard-hit balls. But at the end of the day, at the end of the week, at the end of the month, at the end of the season, at the end of a player's career, it doesn't matter how – as long as you look at a lot of at-bats, the hard hit balls always happen the same. The soft contact happens random, different, crazy ways. So you could throw three fastballs right down the middle, and guess what? I take two of them, and I swing and miss on the third one, and I'm out.
Mm-hmm.
And so it looks like fastballs right down the middle is the way to go. Well, what happens the next time I come to the plate? Do I get a little better? Do I make an adjustment? And the answer is yes.
Mm-hmm.
So throwing fastballs down the middle three in a row just because I got away with it doesn't mean that it's good strategy.
Right.
So one of the arguments against EV is, well, yeah, the hard hit balls show up like that, but so do the strikeouts and the soft contact. And my answer is, well, yes, that's true. And don't get me wrong, soft contact and strikeouts happen more often in EV efficient sequences, but they also happen in terrible, awful, ridiculously awful sequences. You also get strikeouts and pop-ups and weak ground balls because there's a 70% fail rate no matter what. So no matter what you do, there's a 70% fail rate on the hitter side.
Right.
And sometimes it's 90% fail rate. But at the end of the day, that fail rate works itself out in the weak contact, not in the hard contact. Meaning when you look at all, like we did, all of the hard hit balls in the entire postseason, when you look at all of them, the hard contact happens exactly the same way every day. And that's impossible if it's not effective velocity. That's the only answer to why it happens the same way every single day. And as soon as people really start looking at it through the same lens that I am and they start to see it, there's going to be some dramatic changes in pitch sequencing. Mm-hmm. I can promise you that.
Mm. Folks, Perry, husband, listen, Perry, we got a couple things. One, always leave it at the end, you know, for you to say anything you like. That's something that you wanted to mention. I may have cut you off on something that it was important you wanted to mention. Go ahead and mention that. But before we do, I want everybody to know, tell us about EV Liquid Analytics and the new membership program that you have, because this is one way to really study this and understand it really well. So let's talk about that first.
Okay. You know, as a result of this study against EV, I decided to focus my attention on pitch sequencing and kind of releasing that out to the public, as opposed to trying to keep it a little bit private and stay focused on really elite level. I just decided to do a public membership and once a week do a really deep dive into studies like what we've talked about, and then do pitcher profiles showing guys that are doing it right, guys that are doing it poorly, hitters, weaknesses, all that kind of stuff. And it's based around trying to really highlight what is effective velocity efficient and what is not. And so that's kind of the idea behind the membership. It's a video-based, you get a personal online locker and you get videos sent right to your locker. And it's going to walk you through that process of exactly what liquid analytics is. And that term is basically the idea of understanding which analytics are the most precise and which ones you need to focus on, and then how to do it at game speeds where you're not trying to think about, you know, what was the effective velocity of that last pitch and how do I keep the spread just right on this pitch. It's designed to show you how to use analytics at game speed. That's the idea of that pitch sequencing concept.
And you go to hittingisaguest.com, or is there a different website for that?
Yeah, no, it's hittingisaguest.com. I'll be doing a bunch of like free content, but that's like the premium content. Mm-hmm. And then I'll be doing some more free content as well that kind of runs a little bit parallel to the premium content, but there'll be some YouTube stuff. So just look for EV_liquid analytics on YouTube and on Facebook and Instagram coming pretty soon. I'll start to do some stuff on that in the next few days.
Okay. And folks, we're going to put all this on our show notes and his Twitter at EV Perry Husband. Check him out. There's a lot of great stuff there too. Make sure this is going to be fantastic. Join, be a member, get a lot of great details. Perry, what else, you know, and again, this is our third show, so we've covered a lot, but there's so much more. What was something you really wanted to mention that you didn't get a chance to do?
Well, you know, one of the things, softball at the NCAA level this last year was really kind of a fun, you've seen it really explode over the last few years. The acknowledgement around the country is getting stronger and stronger. The players are getting better and better, but the teams that were EV efficient this last year that had bought into effective velocity, Oklahoma was rated number one going into the College World Series, and UCLA was two, and they're both EV centric as far as the way that they call pitches.
Mm-hmm.
And Oklahoma's side is both offensive and on the pitching side. Oklahoma led the nation in team ERA of 1.06.
Mm. Wow.
Think about that for a second. A team ERA of 1.06, and they play on 200-foot fences.
Yeah, not shorter distance pitching.
So think about that. They were 12 years old. They were playing on that same field. So you talk about, like, being afraid to throw in Coors Field. The softball is throwing at Coors Field every single night.
Only
it's worse than Coors Field because the fences are typically equidistant all the way around. You know, occasionally there's like a 220 center field and 200 down the lines or 205. But it's basically little league distance all the way around. So you can hit oppo homers as easily as you can pull the ball out of the yard or hit it to center. And so these girls are pitching at Coors Field every night, and yet the top pitching team in Major League Baseball, the team ERA is over 3.
Mm-hmm.
So they're having three times more success in controlling runs playing in Coors Field every night. It's a pretty significant thing when you think about it.
Absolutely.
Because they're not hung up on the same things that Major League Baseball is.
Yeah.
When you take out those fears of fly balls, because that's the reason why, one of the reasons why effective velocity has had a tough time gaining traction is because of misinformation about what is really going on. And that's just one of those factors. So I thought it was important to kind of give a shout out to both Oklahoma and UCLA. It was a very, very interesting ending to the season with those two matching up in the College World Series finals.
Absolutely. And Perry, not just that, but also in professional baseball. I mean, you talked about Brett Strom using it with the Houston Astros. Obviously, they've been very successful. There's other organizations using it that have shown benefits in their pitching throughout the year, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. DJ.
I was going to mention Derek Johnson. Look at the Reds, what they're doing, and then you look at their pitching staff. They've really
benefited greatly from one of the worst pitching teams in the game.
Absolutely.
You know, well, in their division, to one of the very elite pitching teams last year, and then he's doing the same thing with the Reds this year.
You know, it just goes to show. I mean, that's what I love. Results, you know, tell it all.
And I mean, and analytics has a point when they say that some of that stuff is anecdotal. You know, it's just there's a lot of factors that go into what makes a pitching team get better. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, we live in a world of timing. Every at bat is so focused on timing. It's like doing a study of the ocean and leaving water out.
Yeah.
If you're not looking at timing as the most important factor in a pitcher-hitter confrontation, then you are literally flipping a coin when it comes to your pitch philosophy.
And you mentioned earlier, you know, they've left some in the studies on fly balls, they left, you know, pop-ups out of the equation. I believe you said that. I mean, you can't leave that stuff out. That's got to be included.
No, that's the best version. If I'm a pitcher, what's the Oklahoma, they led in softball, they led in 10 categories. One of them was team ERA, and the other was fielding percentage.
Hmm.
Because around 70 or 75% of all their outs were pop-ups. So imagine what happens to your defense when instead of trying to focus on ground balls and giving up these 100-mile-an-hour ground balls, you start focusing on timing, and you get a ground ball when you need it, you get a pop-up when you need it, and you focus on trying to get a strikeout when you need it, and you throw pitch sequences that fit that mold, that concept.
Mm-hmm.
When you understand that and you take all the biases out, it comes down to one element, and that's timing. Are you early, late, or on time?
Mm-hmm.
And when you're trying to focus 100% of your pitch sequencing on getting ground balls, I mean, that's like me telling you in our one-on-one game that I go really well to my right. And I mean, so if I tell you that I go really well to my right, then you're probably going to compensate a little bit for that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to adjust. And so do hitters. When I know that the primary focus is to try to get a ground ball, and that's early contact, then what am I going to do? I'm going to be on time for those pitches in that area. And so you're shooting yourself in the foot by having a bias of something like living for the ground ball.
Mm-hmm.
It's a ridiculously overrated concept from my perspective.
And folks, I could tell you this from a coaching standpoint, I would definitely want other teams to hit me more pop-ups than ground balls, because you're gonna I got that part at least, right, Perry? My guys and gals can catch some pop-ups, but you know, you see a lot more errors on ground balls. I mean, that to me, that's just common sense. But Perry, as always, man, this has been outstanding. I wish we could do this for 2-3 hours. I just want to thank you again, because we just keep learning more and more. We will continue to do this. And thanks again for being on the show, buddy.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right, folks, Perry Husband, we told you this was going to be an explosive episode. We love it. Do me a favor, go back and listen to the other two shows that we did with Perry. So this is the third show. There's so much knowledge here, notes. I keep listening to them because I gotta stay up on this stuff. Not easy, but if you really get into it and delve into it, it becomes a little easier, and it's going to help your team tremendously. So thanks, everybody, for joining us on Baseball Outside the Box. I'm your host, Pete Caliendo. If you got any questions, petercaliendo@att.net. Email me. Also, check out Perry Husband at Twitter @EVPerryHusband. The website, hittingisaguest.com, and check his new program out. EV Liquid Analytics. It's a membership. You've got to get it. Make sure you get on top of that right away. Special thank you to Brian Crock, our producer with the Lineup Media Group. Again, I'm your host, Pete Caliendo. Have a great coaching day, and I will see you on the next show.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm. This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.